Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anthony Bubalo. I'm the research director here at the Lowy Institute. It's a great pleasure to welcome our guest today, Greg Sheridan, the foreign editor of the Australian newspaper. Greg has a new book out. It's been out a few months now. It's here, When We Were Young and Foolish. It's on sale at the back, and I'm sure at the end of the talk, if Greg can spare a bit of time, he'll sign a few copies as well. It's a real pleasure to have Greg here. We're talking today about how foreign policy, but in particular how the Cold War and more contemporary foreign events shape the minds of some of our political leaders. But we'll go a little bit broader than that, taking the opportunity of Greg's presence here to dip into his memoirs and to also take the opportunity to kind of touch on some contemporary international issues. Greg, of course, as I said, is the foreign editor of The Australian. He's a former foreign correspondent to Beijing and Washington, was a journalist at the late and great Bulletin magazine, has written four books on Asia and a book on the US-Australia relationship. We also learned from his recent, from this memoir that he is a teetotaler, a former union official, former Labor Party member, a conservative student activist, and a one-time employee of the tax office. So these are things that great little additions to his bio that I learnt from reading this book, which I highly recommend. It's a great, for someone like myself that edits the Institute's work as a research director, it's always great to find good writing, and it's above all well written and interesting and breezy. So I certainly commend it to you. Greg was originally from Sydney. He now resides in Melbourne. And I think Greg has a great line in the book where he says, the difference between Sydney and Melbourne is, in Sydney, if you have a good idea, you throw a party. In Melbourne, if you have a good idea, you found a journal. And I think it's a great kind of reflection on the difference between the two cities. And I got the impression from the memoir that even if you were brought up in Sydney, your heart somehow is in, or your brain somehow is more in Melbourne. He is, of course, also one of our most seasoned observers of international affairs and particularly of Asian affairs. And let's start there. Let's start with international affairs. And let's start, Greg, with your thesis that it was the Cold War in particular and the Cold War debates and discussions around university campuses that has helped to shape some of our current crop of leaders, from Malcolm Turnbull and Bob Carr to Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott. So tell us about your thesis.
Well, thanks, Anthony, and thanks, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out today. I can only imagine this represents your devotion to the Catholic doctrine of indulgences, under which for suffering endured on earth you get time off in purgatory. And so I'll try to make your suffering as exquisite as possible. Well, Anthony, thanks so much for having me here. The four people who figure on the cover of my book, Bob Carr, Malcolm Turnbull, Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott, were all very good friends of mine before they went into politics. And I've been in full-time journalism nearly 40 years, and certainly people who you know before they go into politics, you know them differently from the politicians you meet after you're in journalism and they're in politics. So these four guys were all friends of mine before they went into politics, and except for Kevin Rudd, they were all friends of mine before I went into journalism. And the interesting thing about that whole generation, they're all now in their late 50s, except for Bob Carr, who I guess would be in his late 60s, is that our mindset for politics was formed by the Cold War. And the political battles and struggles that I recount in the book, which run from the early 60s through to the early 80s, were entirely dominated by the Cold War. So it wasn't a question of whether you're interested in foreign policy or not. Tony Abbott and I got active in university politics because we're anti-communists. And in the Cold War, your attitude to communism was really the defining thing about you. And just as in the Second World War, the interesting question was not what was your position on the codification of level crossings, it was how did you feel about Nazism and were you going to fight the Nazis? Well, I felt in the Cold War, the most important question was how did you feel about communism, were you going to fight the communists? And the Cold War imprinted on the minds of its participants a certain strategic outlook, which I think has served people very, very well. That outlook emphasised the importance of values in foreign policy and in politics generally. It emphasised the importance of alliances as the organising principle of international life and indeed of domestic life. It gave you the idea of a long struggle. The Cold War was a long, long struggle whose outcome was never inevitable right up until the last minute. Kim Beazley made a very interesting observation about Barack Obama when he first became president, that Obama was the first post-Cold War president. You might say, what did Bill Clinton have to do with the Cold War? But Clinton was of a generation where even if he hadn't been a foreign policy activist, his whole strategic outlook was formed in the Cold War. And even if you were a dissident from the Western position on something like Vietnam, that was your framework. So all of these politicians, people like Malcolm Turnbull and Tony Abbott, whose politics have been essentially domestic, nonetheless had their outlook framed in the politics of the Cold War. And I think that in a peculiar way, that made Australia actually more cosmopolitan in the 1950s and 60s than it is now, because in the 1960s, ordinary literate people could have intelligent discussions about the Slavic influence on Soviet communism, whereas now foreign policy at the popular level is reduced to whether the Kardashians are more popular than Donald Trump or something like that. So I do think those folks were all formed by the Cold War.
I think it's a really interesting idea. And so what if you look at what does the absence of a Cold War, what does the absence of a grand ideological struggle between two organising ideas mean now for, you know, the current university campuses and the kinds of leaders and politicians that are likely to come out of, or what that have been coming out of that post-Cold War era? What distinguishes them, you think, from that previous generation?
Well, of course, I want to avoid the, you know, the old codger syndrome of saying, when I was a young man, giants strode the world, and now all the young people are hooligans and louts and so forth. I do want to avoid that. But I do think, and of course, I'm glad the Cold War is over. I'm glad we won. I'm glad that there are not tens of thousands of Soviet nuclear missiles pointed at Western targets, including Sydney and Pine Gap and so forth. That's a very good thing. I'm glad that the scourge of communism is all but dead everywhere but North Korea and Cuba. Perhaps you can't certainly describe China as communist these days. I'm glad that the charnel house of mass industrial slaughter that communism was, far exceeding Nazism, is now in the dustbin of history. That's all a good thing. But it is the truth that a certain crisis in modernity in the Western world has coexisted with the post-Cold War period. And there's a certain question in Western societies now about what is politics for? What is the ultimate transcendent purpose? And you get a descent into kind of managerialism on one hand. On the other hand, you get very weird millenarian cults. The world is about to end because of climate change, or the world is about to end because of immigration or something or other. You've had a rise of left and right-wing populism. You've had the sense that conventional politics is in a sense of entropy and exhaustion. And at the same time, I think foreign affairs has been relegated to a boutique issue. Even though we've never been more globalised and we've never had a more cosmopolitan society, and foreign affairs in terms of having immigrant neighbours and so forth and immigrants in your family and all that, that's all a living, breathing social reality. But the interest in foreign affairs, I mean, I can remember in the 1980s, Philippines presidential elections were very big issues in Australian politics and in the Australian media and so on. Now it's very, very hard to get coverage for something like a Filipino general election. And I think that the foreign policy obsessions that you get in universities now are often bear no relation to national interests or reality. You know, people want to read and write about the United Nations endlessly, as though the United Nations bore any relation to anything. And yet they don't want to study Thai history or the Malay emergency and what that means for contemporary Malaysian politics. That's all. Don't bother me with that rubbish. I want to deal with the grand, you know, kumbaya theories of the world. And I think paradoxically, we've never had access to more information, yet we're more, in my view, provincial and less genuinely strategic than we've been in a very long time.
No, it's certainly something that we as an institute, it's a concern that we share, not just in terms of the general discussion and debate of foreign policy, which we were keen to encourage, but also, you know, in the media's coverage of foreign affairs and international affairs, which has shrunk. I know that you've had a passionate interest in Southeast Asian affairs for many years. Does it concern you, you know, when you hear that, you know, many of our universities are shutting down language courses on Southeast Asia politics? You mentioned in your book the great Dennis Warner, who you described as our leading Southeast Asian correspondent. A couple of years ago, his son, Nick Warner, gave an address to our inaugural media award talking about his father. Are you worried about this kind of trend both in media and in this kind of scholarly study of Southeast Asia? And what impact do you think that will have on our ability to interact with the region?
Yes, Anthony. Frankly, I don't want to sound alarmist, but it is extremely alarming. We talk about Australia in the Asian century. You know, the Rudd, Gillard and Abbott and no doubt Turnbull governments all talk a good game about Asian engagement. There are now, in absolute numbers, fewer university students studying Indonesian in Australia than there were in the last years of the White Australia policy. So Australia was then only about two-thirds as many people as we are now. But we had, in absolute, and we had a colour-based immigration policy, or at least partly colour-based, and we had more interest and more students studying Indonesian, both at high school and university, than we have now. All the Indonesian departments are virtually shut down, and there are very, very few left, of maybe one university in each city. At the same time, the fashion in academia, I think, has been very bad. You've seen a decline of area studies and a rise of theoretical studies. So people are less inclined now to study the hard grind of Indonesian politics and Indonesian history and Indonesian economy. They're more inclined to do a theoretical study of, military withdrawal from civic life or something like that, and then use Indonesian examples and Thai examples and so on. I think that's a terrible way to approach pedagogy. All theory is the work of the devil, really, and in foreign relations, theory is absolutely worthless. It's of no use at all. The specific is vastly more important than the general, and you need to be studying real countries, real languages. It's vastly more important, if you're dealing with Indonesia, to know that Prabowo was married to Suharto's daughter and so on, than it is to have any idea about post-military conflict societies and so forth. But within Australia, we not only have this tremendous decline in language and area studies, but we have no public interest in it, you know. And sad to say, the new metrics, the digital media, sometimes bear this out. I remember writing what I thought was a really clear expository column about the red shirt, yellow shirt conflict in Thailand a few years ago, and it elicited as a blog 12 comments or something, or 19 or something like this. But if I write about the Palestinian-Israeli dispute, it will elicit 200 or 300 comments. Now, I'm not uninterested in the Palestinian-Israeli dispute, but how is it that the Australian public can have a more passionate discussion about Jewish settlements in the West Bank than it can have about murderous conflict in Thailand, virtually right next door to us? And of course, even discussing the Middle East is a kind of a boutique thing, really. Political coverage is essentially gossip these days. At the same time, you've got wonderful specialist institutions like the Lowy Institute, fabulous websites like The Interpreter and The Strategist. So the specialist audience, in a sense, has never been better catered for. But the broad audience of literate people, I think, is neither paying attention nor is well served in the foreign affairs area.
Let's come back to leaders, and we've had a change of leadership in Australia. Turnbull is one of the people you talk about in your book. He's on the cover. What are the things that, you know, from your knowledge of him at university, those kind of formative Cold War days, what are the things do you think that he will carry through in terms of being a foreign policy prime minister, the issues that are important, going to be important to him, and the way he approaches foreign policy?
I think there's much less change in substance between Turnbull and Abbott than commentators suggest. There is a change in style. I didn't know Malcolm nearly as well as I knew Tony Abbott or even Bob Carr or even probably Kevin Rudd, but I first met Malcolm at Sydney University when I was an undergraduate in the mid-1970s, and he was an impossibly glamorous figure. He's always terribly brainy, the only fellow really that I used to feel kind of intimidated by as a young man. Then I went to work at the Bulletin, where Malcolm was already a journalist. And by the way, what a smart editor Trevor Kennedy was. He hired Malcolm Turnbull, Tony Abbott, Bob Carr, two prime ministers and a premier and foreign minister, and me as well. But and all these others went on to immense, august positions of national leadership. I'm still doing essentially exactly the same things as I was doing. I am glad, by the way, though, that they left journalism, because they're very, very talented journalists, and they wrote about the same things I wrote about. So I'm glad that they left and ceased being competition. Malcolm was always so brainy. He always had a million things going on at once. You know, he could do his law course and write brilliant columns and conduct legal cases and so on, and then ask what should he do after morning tea. He was a bit inclined to be a bit robust in argument. If you disagreed with him, that could be quite a vigorous sort of experience. He wasn't as deeply involved in Cold War politics as the other three. The other three were all much more deeply involved in the ideological battles against communism. But nonetheless, Malcolm wrote about and was influenced by the Cold War. He interviewed Margaret Thatcher, and he wrote about you know, the fight against communism within the labour movement and so forth. I think, though, there's a restlessness about Malcolm. He tends to be less obsessed with an E-Day fix than, say, Abbott was. I think a big formative experience of his life was being such a successful merchant banker and so on. So he's a deal maker, and a lot of foreign affairs is indeed transactional. I think that will be a strength of Malcolm's. But I do think Malcolm has settled on some long-term values. A few years ago, in about 2011, I was very critical of a speech he made about China, where I thought, as a lot of Australian businessmen are inclined to do, he looked at China purely through a commercial lens and saw nothing but opportunity. But I must say, in his speeches since then, he's been, I think, very balanced on China, and he's seen both the upside and the strategic challenges. He's been very robust in calling for China to be more transparent and more restrained in its actions in the South China Sea. He's developed a close friendship with Kurt Campbell, the former US Assistant Secretary of State, who's rather a hawk on China. And so I think one personality trait that Malcolm has is an adaptiveness, a willingness to take on new information. And so that means he's a little bit less of a Cold War archetype than the others. He has a little bit less of a fixed strategic grid, I think, and is a bit more adaptive. That's a strength, but it can also be a weakness. But I think he represents broad continuity within Australia.
It's claimed that obviously post-university days, when he defended, he was a lawyer in the famous Spycatcher case, that this has left with him a scepticism of intelligence agencies. Do you think that's right? Do you think it's possible for a prime minister to be sceptical of the intelligence agencies that ultimately were report to him?
Well, I think he did have a healthy scepticism for the intelligence agencies, but he has a healthy scepticism about everything, really. And of course, that is in a sense the journalistic impulse. You know, I once asked Trevor Kennedy, the editor at the Bulletin, when I went there, why he hired me. Strange question to ask, really, but I hadn't really had much journalistic experience and so forth. And he said, well, mate, he said, yeah, you could write okay and everything, but what I really saw was that disagreeable, quarrelsome, basically unpleasant personality, which is so essential for success in journalism. And I said, thank you, Trevor. I could have hugged him at that time, although you don't hug Trevor Kennedy generally, really. But now, Malcolm, of course, infinitely more polished and agreeable person than me, but the healthy scepticism, the response to life which says, oh, yeah, and what's your evidence for that, is essentially a journalistic impulse, which I think the others also shared, Abbott, Carr and Rudd. Having said all that, I think in this latest terrorist incident, something that's been notable is the way Turnbull has stuck very, very close to the advice of ASIO and the federal police and so forth. He seemed to be a bit sceptical about ASIO's advice on Huawei, the Chinese telecoms giant, which was kept out of participation in the NBN, a decision we made in a similar vein to the Americans, in contrast to the British. So it was an on-balance kind of decision. He seemed to be a bit sceptical of the ASIO advice. But I think these are elements of temperament. I don't think he's going to disregard ASIO advice on terrorism or anything like this. And I think being in politics these years, being in the cabinet, I think Turnbull is a very, very mainstream figure. And I would expect on national security and counter-terrorism, he will hew very closely to the National Security Agency's advice. I mean, he'll be the boss. Prime Ministers are the boss. Abbott was the boss. Abbott didn't do what the agencies told him reflexively. But nonetheless, you take the advice of your experts pretty seriously.
Mm. I want to go somewhere slightly different. I mean, there's another great line in the piece where, in the book, where you say, journalism sometimes seemed like the continuation of undergraduate life by other means. Which is great. You also detail in the book that kind of typically conservative student activists tended to get the rough treatment at university, both verbally and sometimes physically as well. Do you think for that reason that kind of treatment at university leaves more of an imprint on conservative politicians? It stays with them longer than, say, people go into the left or the Labor side of politics?
That's a very interesting question, Anthony, and in a sense difficult to generalise about. The conflicts of the Cold War had another paradoxical consequence in the student activism, which I describe in the book. It wasn't a Liberal versus Labor contest at university. The student politics was controlled by the extreme left, by an amalgam of all the different sectarian strands of communism in Australia and by their far-left fellow travellers. I mean, some of you will be old enough to remember there were three big communist parties in Australia: Communist Party of Australia, Marxist-Leninist, which was Maoist, the Socialist Party of Australia, which was slavishly pro-Moscow, and the Communist Party of Australia, which was notionally independent but never really disagreed with Moscow on anything and got money from Moscow, like the SPA. Then there were 100 small communist sects, a lot of Trotskyite sects, the Socialist Workers' Party, Direct Action, Spartacist League, and lots of others. These were the people who controlled student politics, and they were very powerful people. They also controlled a lot of trade unions in Australia, the Metal Workers Union, the Builders Labourers Federation, the Building Workers Industrial Union, a lot of other unions. They had big institutional power. A consequence of all that was that all the mainstream groups, Labour, Liberal, the religious groups, the Jewish groups, because the hatred of Israel was a salient feature of the left, the Christian groups, the Evangelical Union, and Tony Abbott and I were involved in the National Civic Council groups, BA Santa Maria's organisation, we all formed an alliance against the extreme left. Now, anyone who fought against the extreme left got the rough end of the pineapple, and that applied as much to Labour Party people as to Conservatives. Michael Danby, currently the member for Melbourne Ports, was savagely beaten by a group of Maoist thugs on the eve of his campaign to get a whole series of Melbourne universities to disaffiliate from the Australian Union of Students. He was hospitalised for days, he had to go back for extra neurological tests and so on. Peter Costello, who was the chairman of the Monash University Students Council, and in those days was not a liberal, ran a thing called the Social Democratic Students Federation of Australia, and was more than anything an evangelical Christian, ran Baptist missions on the beaches in summer and so on. He was also attacked by anarchists, had his arm broken and so on. Tony Abbott, I guess you could say he was more conservative, although we were more in the DLP-NCC mould. I mean, Tony was probably a bit more conservative than me. I was a small R Republican. I guess I felt in a sense an identity with the Labor movement, but didn't like the influence the communists had. In a sense, we were neither conservative nor not conservative. For instance, the DLP, the political party that Santa Maria was associated with, it was the first party in Australia to oppose the White Australia policy. When I went to university in 1975 and the fall of Saigon, the issue that we were most active on in the Democratic Club for 2 or 3 years was to try to convince the government to bring Vietnamese, Cambodian and Laotian refugees to Australia. Santa Maria, who was in many ways very conservative, was miles ahead of everybody else in Australian politics on this. Gough really hated the Indochinese refugees because they were anti-communist and he thought they would be anti-Labor if they came to Australia. And Fraser was quite slow, although he later gave himself great plaudits for eventually taking some Indochinese. He was very, very slow, and it was really Santa Maria who campaigned relentlessly to get these folks admitted into Australia because they'd been our allies in war, they were our friends, they were our brothers. Didn't matter what ethnicity they were. So sort of the conservative term, I think, is not quite right. I think we were anti-communist more than anything. I think the people who went through that in student politics did become quite tough political activists. And, you know, Bob Carr, Tony Abbott, Peter Costello, they're very tough politicians. And, you know, I went from student activism to working for a trade union at a time of great trade union conflict. And really, the trade union conflicts were markers of Queensbury rules compared to student politics. So I do think that gave people a certain ideological formation and a certain personal toughness, which has stood them in good stead.
And looking back at the Abbott prime ministership in terms of, you know, Abbott's, the issues that Abbott was prominent on in foreign policy, do you see any vestiges of those Cold War battles, university days, in the issues that he certainly championed, the response to MH17, the involvement in Iraq and Syria, those kind of, you know, the kind of the reference to the shirt fronting of Putin, that kind of very values based campaigning style, is that a remnant of his university?
Yes, absolutely. I think Abbott was sort of the archetype of the Cold War mindset. But I'd say to you, in all honesty, so was Rudd. I mean, the fact that Rudd chose to make his first speech in Beijing as Prime Minister in Mandarin and then include a trenchant, uncompromising passage on human rights is just what you'd expect from a Cold War warrior, which is how Rudd described himself to me, as a small c, small w, Cold War warrior. And he too had been formed in, you know, confrontations with the North Korean diplomats when he was in Beijing, as I was in 1985. Similarly with Abbott. Abbott was a values-based politician and an alliance-based foreign policy thinker. And he saw the central role of the United States in all geostrategic issues. And one of his purposes was to stiffen the resolve of the Americans. And that's one reason he went so early into Iraq, both because he thought it was a just cause and because he had a strategic purpose of trying to make the Americans, who have become, I think, very impotent and weak under Obama, trying to make them stronger. At the same time, I wouldn't attribute that all to the Cold War. That's also partly the Abbott personality. Abbott is not so much a hard man as an incurable romantic, you know. There's a Jewish sage in the book Frank Knopfelmacher who gave me a character reading on Irish-Australian Catholic politicians once, although Abbott's background is English. I think culturally he was part of the Irish-Australian milieu. And Frank said to me in this marvellous Czech accent, he said, you know, the one thing about the Irish, no cause is too hopeless for them to embrace. They always buy a ticket on the last train going to an evacuated city. And And I think there's something about Abbott of that, you know, the romantic who is going to be the last man standing in what he thinks is a good cause. That's part of Abbott's temperament, I think, which is beyond the Cold War. Although, as Prime Minister, his actual actions were quite moderate and temperate and always had the support of the national security chiefs and so forth, and were consistent with the actions of previous Prime Ministers, Howard and Hawke and so forth.
Yeah. All right, we'll take a few questions now from the audience. Raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question. Wait for the microphone. Tell us who you are. And then we'll take a question from you. Any questions?
My name is Philippa Barr. I just wanted to ask you for an opinion. Do you think that given universities can be impossibly theoretical, we shouldn't be looking for politicians or recruiting politicians from outside of universities, and in particular from outside of university politics, i.e. does that play too great a role in contemporary Australian politics?
That's a really good question for which I have no sensible answer. I reveal in this memoir of mine that I never bothered to finish a university degree. Now, I would never advise that kind of harebrained action to any young person today. We have become a very credentialist society, and we haven't quite got that American disease where you just go on getting degrees forever and ever and ever until you almost retire. You know, it's like Southeast Asian youth politics. You're the UMNO youth leader in Malaysia, and you go from that into retirement, you know, into old age and so on. But I was tremendously unimpressed with the quality of courses that I was offered at university, even in the mid-70s. I thought their relationship to reality was quite tenuous. In economics at Sydney University, you had two choices: political economy, which was pure Marxism, and mainstream economics, which was pure mathematics. And both Marxism and mathematics cannot capture the reality of the human economy, you know. And I was equally bad at both Marxism and mathematics, and I thought surely there has to be something, some other way of dealing with reality. And I think the decline of the humanities at universities, nobody wants to study them much anymore, and they're very poorly taught, and they've become comprehensively theoretical. I think this is a great betrayal of young people. Young people are very idealistic. They go to university seeking truth and beauty, and they end up with Foucault and post-structuralist theory that tells them the author has no independent agency and everything is social conditions and so on. I mean, it's completely crackers, really. And I'm encouraged by the birth of Campion College in Sydney, the first Australian liberal arts college in the American tradition, which has a curriculum based on the great books of the Western canon. Now, the hypercritical response has become so routine in Australian academic and intellectual life that you don't study the great texts at university. All you study is the critique of Western society. But you don't know anything about Western society before you study the critique, you know. And nothing could be better for young people than to be exposed to the great texts, the great books of Western society, but our universities don't do it. However, the human spirit is very brave and bold, and it's astounding how many young people manage to educate themselves despite the best efforts of their lecturers and professors.
There is also in that question, and I'll come back in a second, there's a question that flows out of that question about the professionalisation of politics. And the kind of the sense that people go from student politics to working as a staffer to and that this has somehow degraded our politics. Do you agree with that view? Is there and I don't want you to recuse yourself from fogyism again, but is there some sense that we've seen a degradation in the political class and the kinds of people that are going into politics?
Well, you know, there's a famous line of Kim Beazley Sr., Kim Beazley's dad, who said, when I came into the Labor Party, it consisted of the cream of the working class, and when I left, it consisted of the dregs of the middle class. Now, I think that was a bitter, unnecessarily bitter and unfairly bitter comment. I feel quite conflicted about this question of the professionalisation of politics. I think it's good for political parties to have some true professionals in it, some people whose vocation is electoral politics, and that because you need to be good at it. You need to be good at all the technical questions of politics. But on the other hand, it's also very good for our parliament to have a diverse range of human experience. People who have been in business, farmers, people who have been workers, real workers. I mean, both sides of politics face this challenge. Labor Party is full of former union officials, but they're not people who came off the shop floor to become union officials. They're people who went from university into the research departments of the unions and then the advocacy departments of the unions. Whereas, you know, we used to have boilermakers and so forth. We can't go back to the past or anything, but I do think the political parties are grappling with this question of how do they keep a breadth in their gene pool and, you know, recruiting local champions, maybe plebiscitary pre-selections, although they have their problems too. But I do think that's a challenge for our political system, and no one can deny that the political system has less credibility than it needs and therefore can't meet the policy challenges that it has. So this is something I think we can all apply our minds to.
You need the journalists, the lawyers, the merchant bankers, or in fact people that are all of the above.
Absolutely.
Greg Ken Gillespie. I'd just like to make a comment, first of all, on your assessment that your university classmates went on to great things and you are still doing what you're doing. I firmly see you as fulfilling one of those leadership roles in our country with your intellect and your words, so I wouldn't belittle myself too much on that. I think one of the things that happened in conjunction with the demise of the Cold War was the rise of information technology and social media. And the impact that that's had and is having on both the speed of response for leadership decision-making and the shape of our politics. Would you care to comment on that from your perspective?
Well, Ken, thanks very much for that question. You honour me by being here at all, and it's very kind of you to make those remarks. The rise of digital media is tremendously disruptive, and, you know, it's kind of an article of faith that you have to say disruption is good. You have to come and say disruption is good. You're not allowed... I'm a contemporary journalist. If I said disruption was bad, I'd probably, you know, be shot or something. But it does seem to me digital and social media have had very perplexing effects on our politics. Now, it's quite possible that we will domesticate these effects in time. We'll learn better how to deal with them. They're still very new. We're still integrating them. But what they do, I think, is diminish the public square. You know, the old mass media, which had a big chunk of society participating in it, gave you a common ground on which to negotiate policy issues as a society. And a lot of journalists had credibility because they were experts in different areas, and the public, to some extent, accepted their factual adjudication on an issue. So the economics correspondent, you know, Max Walsh or somebody, he would say, well, this is, you know, a fairly good stab at economic reform or whatever, and a chunk of the public would be engaged in this debate. You'd have it in the common media. Now, what you get in the digital age and the social media is that people are deserting the public square and they're going into their own specialist silos. Some of these specialist silos are extremely good, like the Lowy Institute and the Interpreter. Fantastic. Nobody would be unhappy with people spending time at the Interpreter. But a lot of these silos are characterised simply by the vehemence of their opinion, by the strength, the emotion of their opinion. They might be extreme opinions, or they might be moderate opinions but expressed in an extreme way. They're also very vituperative and personal. If you write a measured, judicious post, you won't get very many readers. If you say, guess what, Kevin Rudd is really a child molester, guess what, Tony Abbott is really a secret agent of Vatican thought police, wants to control Australian girls or something like this, a lot of people will visit that website. It also appeals to the base. You know, if you put Kim Kardashian attacks Madonna while Oprah looks on, you get lots and lots of clicks. You know, that's real clickbait, And I'm a fanatical Canterbury Bankstown Bulldogs supporter. And I approach the Bulldogs the way a lot of people approach politics. I don't want to read any criticism of them. I only want to read websites which tell me how great they are and that they've been persecuted by Bolshevik referees and that the officials hate us and that the world is a conspiracy against the Bulldogs and so forth. Now, that's kind of all right as an approach to football. It's not a great approach to politics. And you are seeing now the rise of politicians in the West who exemplify and capture the worst populist instincts of the digital media. And if in the United States President Donald Trump one day welcomes the British Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn and the French President Marine Le Pen to a summit in the Oval Office, I think I will seek political asylum in New Zealand, change my name and give up politics.
Thanks very much and good afternoon. My name is John Osborne. I'm a director at the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, but I'm here in my private capacity. I'm interested in what's long been acknowledged by the left in their own words as the march through the institutions. They seem to be, on the collective side of the debate, very good at it, whether it be academia, as you've mentioned, the media, the judiciary and so on. Do you see that as continuing, and do you think there is in any way a conservative, liberally minded counterbalance to that? And also, in terms of the more thoughtful up-and-comers, you talked about that excellent stable of talent at the Bulletin. Looking around you now, in politics and outside of politics, who do you see as the very thoughtful, deep thinkers, people who are likely to make a valuable and lasting contribution to foreign affairs and regional and global security in Australia into the future?
Well, look, those are pretty big questions, aren't they? I have the capacity to be a shocking bore on the first question, so I'm going to limit myself to a couple of minutes. The theme, that term, the long march through the institutions, I think comes from Antonio Gramsci, and it was a theory of politics, how the left should practice politics, that they weren't trying to win elections, they weren't trying to win 50% plus one on a common program which they could implement. What they were trying to do was capture institutions, and this was a long generational process. So it was a long march, to adopt the term of the Chinese Civil War, but through the institutions. And you have to say the left has been extraordinarily successful in establishing the dominance of their paradigm in cultural and judicial and government institutions. People talk about the power of the press, but there must be in Australia billions of dollars worth of commentary which is subsidised one way or another by the taxpayer. Not only the $1.2 billion for the ABC, but all of the websites like The Conversation and so forth, which are subsidised by universities, and Griffith Review and so on. These are all good things. I don't want them to be burnt down or taken away or anything. But they pretty much all have a left liberal point of view on everything. It's a single world view. And there are certain doctrinal tenets in this worldview. You may not question, same-sex marriage. That if you question that, you will be tarred and feathered and run out of town. You may not question extravagant responses to global warming. And there are a whole lot of other litmus test things. There's a whole sort of intricate code of sexual politics that you have to observe. It's terribly easy to trip over yourself and make a mistake, and even with the best will in the world, and then you've got to issue infinite, multiple, preemptive apologies to everyone you may have offended. In Europe, there are kind of a vast panoply of ethnic protocols that you have to observe and so on. This worldview, I think, is ultimately fairly destructive, although a lot of the people who express its tenets don't understand it. It is really a form of hostility to Western capitalist society, which is very destructive. You know, I spend a lot of time going around Southeast Asia visiting Islamist groups, and on their bookshelves, There will be works of the Quran and extreme Arab interpretations of the Quran and so on. But there'll always be books by John Pilger and Noam Chomsky and so on. And these people are, and Tariq Ali, these people are lionized in our popular culture as though they're the great sages. Everything Noam Chomsky and John Pilger write is complete nonsense and almost falsifiable, almost kind of technically falsifiable nonsense. You know, I remember John Pilger accusing Gareth Evans of plotting the return of the Khmer Rouge to rule in Cambodia and so on. He can make these astoundingly insane analytical statements, and just his fame rises ever higher. The more idiotic the statement, the more certain he is to be invited onto the ABC as a great Australian and a living legend and so forth. And the space for really independent thinking. I mean, News Corporation is independent. We're not dominated by the zeitgeist, and we have a million different contending voices within our stable, but we don't have to, in the end, justify ourselves to a government grants committee, which is always peopled by folks with this same worldview and who replace themselves. Part of the long march through the institutions is that you hire replicants of yourself over and over and over again. So the ABC is a wonderful institution, many, many talented people. But everybody there has a left liberal worldview. You can't think of a single conservative in the ABC because it's somehow or other it's against the culture to hire a notable conservative. Well, that's not really how it's meant to be, you know. It's meant to be diverse and so forth. Now, breaking that kind of quasi-monopoly up, that's very hard. People really need to create their own independent space, and you know, the cliche is that conservative groups are funded by business and they're very rich, and poor left-wing groups struggle because they're all working. In fact, the left-wing groups are vastly funded by enormous government grants and increasingly by left-of-centre business folk as well. Whereas most business doesn't want to have anything to do with conservative groups because it's very dangerous. They'll get targeted if they're running a campaign, if they're seen to be involved in a campaign which is saying, say, that the coal industry is a legitimate industry, which produces, by the way, 15% of our national income or something, then they'll be targeted for consumer retribution by green activist groups which are mostly ultimately funded by the taxpayer. So therefore, business doesn't want to do that. It'll only fund the things which are directly and narrowly in its self-interest, or other than that, it'll fund the arts or the opera or something to earn some goodwill. So that's a very long-winded. I promised I'd be short, but that's very long-winded. That's the problem. I have no idea what the solution is. Who are the bright young thinkers? Well, for all the laments I have about contemporary politics, I do think people go into politics with good intentions to try to make the society better. I think that's true on the Labor and the Liberal side. One of the good things out of the last cabinet reshuffle was that quite a lot of people got promoted who really do have something to offer. I think Josh Frydenberg and Christian Porter and Matthias Cormann on the Liberal side are really very smart, conscientious, hardworking, dedicated Australians. Similarly, on the Labor side, there's a swag of good, smart people, Andrew Lee and Ed Husic. I think there's just loads of people on both sides who want to make a contribution and who have the wherewithal to do it. They have to somehow or other rehabilitate the political system in the public eye and regain the authority. You see, one of the tragedies of the Abbott government is it came into power with a coherent program, none of which it could implement because it couldn't get a single thing passed through the Senate. Well, that is a difficulty of our political system now. The idea of democracy is you elect a government, it has a program, it implements its program. If you think the program's rubbish after 3 years, you throw it out. We can't do that now. And Western societies all have one or other version of this problem. The power of nope, the ability to simply block things, the power of blocking minorities is very great. Maybe that makes coherent government impossible.
Down front here.
You described American foreign policy as becoming weak under Obama. Sort of a two-part question. First of all, do you then support a President Bush approach or approach somewhere in the middle? And secondly, what do you feel Australia's role should be in supporting America as its role as a world leader?
Well, yes, I think Obama has been a terrible disappointment. I really tried to support Obama for as long as possible, and he was much better in his first term than in his second term, partly because he chose to have big cats around him in his first term. He had Robert Gates, Bush's defence secretary. He became Obama's defence secretary. He had Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, Kurt Campbell as Assistant Secretary of State for this part of the world. These were big cats, and although Obama gave them less autonomy than we thought at the time, and things were more and more determined on domestic politics priorities within the White House, nonetheless, these were big figures, and they generated and sustained confidence. A lot of America's power is a combination of both its genuine hard power, its genuine economic power, and the affect that it has, just the mystique, the aura of power. And that is a tremendous asset, a terrible thing to burn up. Now, in his second term, Obama consciously chose a very, very weak national security team. Really, you know, a Secretary of State who was a ditherer and a flummoxer, and a series of Secretaries of Defence, none of whom made any impact at all, and none of whom had any real traction or any real ability. I mean, who can remember that a few months ago the Obama administration was telling us it would conduct freedom of navigation exercises in the 12 nautical mile zone of disputed artificial islands created by China in the South China Sea? Ash Carter, the American Defense Secretary, told us he was going to do this, and the American system lined itself up. All the allies came in behind it. We in Australia said, yes, that's a good idea. We might do it ourselves to support the Americans. Pro-American commentators, you know, Peter Jennings, for whom I have infinite respect, said, yep, this is a good idea. We should. So the whole American system around the world fell into line, got moving, and then Obama kind of said, guess what, I was just joking. Didn't really mean it. I'm not going to do it after all. In fact, he didn't even say that. He just said nothing, you know. I never thought it was necessarily a good idea for Obama to bomb in Syria. But what I think was a very bad idea was to say to Assad, if you use chemical weapons, by God, we're going to bomb you. Then Assad uses chemical weapons, and then Obama says, well, actually, I was just joking. I was just kidding. You do that a few times, and you erode American credibility. And one of Obama's problems is no one in the world now is scared of him. Now, George W. Bush had the opposite problem. He scared the bejesus out of his enemies, but he also scared his friends quite a lot, you know. Obama is overcorrected. He no longer scares anybody, although being his friend can be quite dangerous, as he demonstrated when he embarrassed Abbott over climate change in Brisbane. What should our role be? We have an immense national interest in making the American alliance system function. If the American measure or margin of superiority in our region militarily is declining, we don't want to abandon America, therefore. Rather, we want to make ourselves part of America's irreducible strategic minimum, one of the things America will never give up. If one day America says, well, actually, we're going to give up on the South China Sea, we want them never to say, actually, we're going to give up on Australia. So in that narrow sense, we want to ensure the alliance is strong. But also, we have an ability to help make the alliance system work well by engaging America in our region, supporting America in the Middle East. That doesn't mean we do that blindly or we never disagree with them. We retain our national autonomy. We don't join any bad cause that they're leading. But where we can, we support them as strongly as possible, because if we don't like the world with American leadership, we're going to like it much less without American leadership.
I'm going to take the chair's privilege and ask a final question and bring it back to this theme of the Cold War and the kind of leaders it produced. We're now in an era, particularly in our own region, where there are questions being raised about what kind of regional power or indeed superpower China will be. It's not quite the Cold War, it's no great ideological conflict, but there is nevertheless nervousness. There's great interest in the economic opportunity that China produces, but there's nervousness about the military power that China has. How is that debate about China likely to impact kind of our future and future political generations. And you touched on it a little bit when you mentioned that you've got people in the business community here that see the upside of China but don't necessarily the downside. You know, when you ask people in the national security community in Australia, look, if we had to choose between the US and China, what would we do? And they said, look, it's almost axiomatic. We would always side with the US. But is that going to play out in public, given that there are, you know, segments of the Australian population, the business community, that see our economic future really tied to it? So how is that more muddier, kind of less kind of clear-cut potential competition or conflict going to shape our country and our leaders in the future?
It's very genuinely unpredictable. I think you can say a few things, that the attachment to the US alliance will endure, and I do think it is axiomatic we would always choose the Americans, because there will only be a conflict if China does some outrageous action. I mean, you can posit it as a kind of platonic ideal. Would you choose America or would you choose China? And most people would choose America because it's a democracy and so forth. But we'll never face that choice as a platonic ideal. What we'll be dealing with is, you know, God forbid, touch wood, I don't think this will happen, probably never will happen, but, you know, China invades Taiwan or something. And there'll be television pictures about Taiwanese people being bombed and shelled and so forth and killed and everything. Well, the Australian public would polarise in a quarter of a nanosecond behind the Americans in a situation like that. So that's a melodramatic way of saying the US alliance will endure. That's one marker in the debate. Another marker in the debate is that the economic relationship with China will be enormously important to Australia. Of course, we have other important economic relationships as well, not least with the United States, which is a massive investor in Australia. We have a big trade relationship with the United States, but they have $1 trillion of investment in Australia, many, many multiples of China's investment in Australia. I don't think it is an either-or situation, but a lot of it depends on internal Chinese dynamics. Then there's a question, can we influence those dynamics at all? Well, it's good for us to have a robust dialogue with the Chinese, but, you know, one of the many splendid revelations we got out of Bob Carr's Diary of a Foreign Minister, what a valuable book that is for anyone interested in foreign policy, is that the Chinese don't have a serious dialogue with us about, for example, what they're doing with North Korea. They go through their talking points. So even at the highest levels of government, national security and so on, we send our folks to Beijing, foreign minister and so on, they get the Chinese talking points and that's it. That's it. So they're just not talking to us about their serious strategic actions. They have dialogues with us, but they're not actually talking to us. The Chinese system remains in many respects opaque. Xi Jinping certainly seems a stronger leader than his predecessors and has centralised more power. On the other hand, there's evident quite a lot of paranoia within the ruling system in China about what happens if economic growth subsides even further and will they face social disorder and so forth. These are really imponderables. One of the things that is affecting Chinese behaviour, I think, is Obama's weakness. That's certainly affecting Putin's behaviour in Russia. And certainly across Europe and across Asia, all American allies are worried about what the vacuum of American power, what incentives it sets up to sort of semi-rogue states like Russia, or simply adventurous states, as China sometimes is. Having said all that, China has generally not given us irrational policy. It finally has been rational and limited in its actions. It's been extremely assertive and very destabilising in its actions in the South China Sea, but it hasn't actually, engaged in a shooting war with anyone or anything like that. I think Australia's response up till now has been very sensible, very sensible. We tell the Chinese, look, we want to engage with you, we love you, we appreciate Chinese culture and we want to do business with you, but don't think for a moment you're ever going to win us away from the American alliance. This is absolutely fundamental. John Howard told me, for a previous book I did in the US-Australia alliance, he used to say to the Chinese, look, if we want to have a constructive discussion, let's talk about the things that we can cooperate about. If you want to waste time lecturing me about the American alliance, he didn't quite use these words, Howard, he said, you can do that if you like, but it's not going to have the slightest effect on anything we, and, you know, the Chinese being above all pragmatic, came to the view, well, there's no point talking to Howard about this. Let's just move on to the trade matters where we can, every now and again they would try to bully Howard and that would be unsuccessful, and so they'd move on. we don't have a terribly sophisticated China dialogue in Australia. We have very sophisticated business people who are very good at doing business with China. And we have quite a solid phalanx of academics who study their different silos of China. But we don't really have a very elevated debate about China, and we have more debate about China than we have about any other Asian nation. I think we have a less sophisticated debate about China in Australia than we do in America, and it's a great conceit of Australians that they think they can tell Americans how to run their China policy. What we can do is we can tell Americans what's important to us about their China policy, and they'll pay attention to us because they're our allies. But the Americans get better access in Beijing than we do and have hundreds of times more China scholars in their system than we do and have a more hooked up system than we have. But overall, the last 6 months has been kind of encouraging from China. They've scaled back the tension a bit in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, and they wanted to have a good visit from Xi to Obama. I think they are very concerned with their own domestic economy. But what the limit of their strategic ambitions is, I don't know. And I don't think that's a settled question within China yet. You can list a whole lot of dynamics in favour of strategic expansion. You can list a whole lot of dynamics which restrain them from that. What the balance is there, I think, is genuinely unknowable. About the only strategically useful thing that Malcolm Fraser ever said was that the future of China remains the great unknowable in our region. And I think that's still true. God bless Malcolm. He did say one sensible thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've run out of time. I'm sure you'll agree with me that Greg has been everything he usually is, interesting, erudite, provocative at times. Please join me in thanking Greg Sheridan.
Thank you.
And we'll see you all next time.